You want to play? Let's play.
Are you ready for it now? Are you ready, ready for it, for it now? Hey, got my crew, got my vibe, and I'm feeling alright. Love energy for life. Got my cool, got my feel, and we're keeping it real. We were made to play tonight.
Back again, love that. Hello and welcome to It's an Arsenal Thing season 3. I'm your host Tom, and with me is a man who sounds like a dove farting into a bucket of wet confetti. It's Silent Dave. All right, my man, lazy nodding. More oomph, please, sir. Dave, it has to be said, does nothing with vigor or haste. He's like a VAR assistant, quite content to plod along without direction or common sense. How are you, podders? Feeling good? Looking good? On the menu tonight, we openly mock the deluded soul known as Jamie O'Hara, who believes Spurs can compete with Manchester City and Liverpool. Connor's back with his report on the first home game of the season from the Emirates against Brendan Buck Rogers Leicester. No Lauren this week, but on Pod 62, she brings us a review of the WSL before the girls kick off their campaign against Manchester City. Connor's also back later on with a player profile of the much-loved Santi Cazorla. We're back in the gun room to discuss the ins and outs of the game. We examine who was hot and who was not. I'll be having that chat with Jay, Mitch and Paul. We bring you the fantastic Ghanaian sports presenter known as Acrobeto, who, excuse the phrase, takes the living piss out of a Chelsea loss against Arsenal. We also ask, who are the most intelligent people in football today? We reveal who can't fill their stadium and also look back to find the king of the Arsenal gingers, the Ron Weasley of football. Have a think and we'll reveal the top five chosen by you later in the show. There's a musical interlude and so much more of the usual nonsense. Are you up for it? Of course you are.
Odegaard, he's the captain of the Arsenal and they call him Odegaard. Odegaard, Odegaard, he's the captain of the Arsenal and they call him Odegaard.
Let's have some suitable background music, Dave. What is this? Are you trying to wind me up? Is this going to be a feature of season 3? You're just going to find all these dusty old tracks you've got hanging about on your PC. Anyway, let's go to the archives. In August 1980, after 235 league games, Liam Brady transferred to Juventus for £514,000. He later played for Sampdoria and Inter, amongst others, before returning to London to play for West Ham. Still from the archives, August 2010, Cesc Fabregas announced he would be 100% focused on playing for Arsenal. After a lot of transfer speculation, he did survive the season, playing 36 games all told. But on the 15th of August 2011, he signed for Barcelona.
You are a compulsive liar.
Still from the archives, August 2019, Arsenal signed left-back Kieran Tierney, the Scottish Terminator, from Celtic for £25 million, and 3 hours later, centre-back David Luiz from Chelsea for £8 million. Alex Iwobi joined Everton for £35 million. Woohoo, what a deal! While Eddie Nketiah joined Leeds United on a season-long loan. On the 15th of August, 2015... Nicholas Bentner, God bless him, signed for Wolfsburg after being released by Arsenal in the summer. He got the old Spanish archer, the elbow. He made 169 appearances and scored 47 times across 9 years. In November, naughty boy, 2018, Bentner was sentenced to 50 days in prison in Denmark for assaulting a taxi driver. 31st of August 2003, The Times reported the league match against Manchester City containing the worst 45 minutes by Arsenal that any fan could remember. It ended Manchester City 1, Arsenal 2. And was the fourth league match of the unbeaten season. Let's have a section on football pranks, why not? Manchester City players managed to completely ruin Mario Balotelli's £150,000 Maserati. His teammates filled his car with kippers, knowing the hot sun would do the rest. The problem was that Balotelli was on holiday for 2 weeks and didn't realise his car was filled with rotten fish and infested with flies until he returned. Lovely.
From Nepal to North London, from Delhi to Dagenham, from the terraces to the armchair, it's an Arsenal Thing podcast. Football's in our DNA.
Right, let's cozy up with Connor for this week's match report against Brendan Buck Rogers' Leicester side. In gonna get into it.
Oh, and what a match report to bring you this week, guys. We were 4-2 winners at home to Leicester City on Saturday afternoon in our very first Premier League home game of the new 2022-2023 Premier League season. And, well, I've been supporting Arsenal for the last 17 years, and really, this performance this past weekend was arguably one of the best that I have ever witnessed, and I'm not exaggerating. It could have been 7, it could have been 8, it could have been 9, 10-0 to the Gunners. To be honest, a 4-2 loss really actually flattered Brendan Rodgers' men. They were outplayed for the entire 90 minutes. They did, though, create the first chance in the 4th minute thanks to Granit Xhaka gifting Leicester possession. Ramsdale saved well from Wesley Fofana, but well, it really was a comprehensive, another very comprehensive victory for the Arsenal. And well, of course, only one man to talk about at the beginning of the report, and that is Gabriel Jesus. He goes from strength to strength in this Arsenal team, and you can clearly see that Arteta and Edu had a clear plan to create the team around the former Manchester City man. And well, although Bukayo Saka wasn't quite at his best yesterday, Gabriel Martinelli simply shone alongside his Brazilian. And well, of course, Granit Xhaka was also arguably joint man of the match. I really struggled to pick between Xhaka, Martinelli and Jesus, but the stats don't lie. 2 goals and 2 assists on his Premier League home debut for Gabriel Jesus. Of course, he's the first Arsenal player since Theo Walcott in 2012. Of course, our 7-3 home victory over Newcastle in December of 2012. He is the first Arsenal player since Walcott to score 2+ goals and provide 2+ assists in a single Premier League game. And on top of that, he becomes the only Arsenal player to score 2 Premier League goals on his home Premier League debut. Unbelievable, Gabriel Jesus. And it's only going to get better and better from here. Well then, let's get into it then. The team news. Mikel Arteta named an unchanged starting 11 from his 11 that he chose in last Friday night's 2-0 away victory against Crystal Palace. And Emile Smith-Rowe and Takahiro Tomiyasu were both fit enough for a place on the bench. And well, as I said, 4 minutes gone, Xhaka, who had tucked in at left back to allow Zinchenko to drift inside and take up a more central position in midfield, gave the ball away carelessly in a dangerous position, and Wesley Fofana was found brilliantly and was one-on-one with Ramsdale all of a sudden, but the defender scuffed his left-footed shot straight at the English goalkeeper Ramsdale, and that was a huge let-off. Leicester started brightly. We were quite slow in the opening 5 or 10 minutes or so, but then after 9 minutes or so, 10 minutes, we created our first opportunity. Gabriel Martinelli's dangerously whipped free kick from the left-hand side of the 18-yard box was flicked just wide of Danny Ward's near post by Gabriel Jesus. It flicked the post, and despite the Brazilian's claims for a corner, the referee signalled for a goal kick. A half a chance, it has to be said. Leicester did have the best chance of the opening few minutes or so on what was a scorchingly hot afternoon in England's capital. At the Emirates Stadium, the temperature recorded was 33 degrees Celsius. Incredible stuff. There were, of course, 2 hydration breaks And well, Timothy Castagna looked dangerous on the right wing for Leicester early on. But Ramsdale parried away a decent centre from the Belgian in the 12th minute as the game failed to really kick into life. And well, in the opening 15 to 20 minutes, a fascinating one-on-one battle between Martinelli and Fofana. Gabriel Martinelli really gave Fofana an afternoon to forget, as did Jesus for Johnny Evans. It was just unbelievable. And in the 16th minute, Gabriel headed over when he was found by Martinelli's free kick just inside the six-yard box. And well, Martinelli's deliveries certainly weren't disappointing early on. And then the first clear-cut Arsenal opportunity came in the 19th minute. Bukayo Saka's inch-perfect left-footed delivery found an unmarked Granit Xhaka storming in at the back post, but his header struck the post before falling kindly to Zinchenko, waiting on the edge of the box. But the Ukrainian's shot found Rosed, and that certainly was our first clear-cut glimpse at goal. And well, from that moment onwards, it was simply Arsenal dominance. And 4 minutes later, after a slow start, we had our goal. Xhaka's chance sparked us into life. And well, Jesus started and finished a simply outstanding Arsenal move. He was dragging Johnny Evans well out of position and brought the Northern Irishman out into the right-hand side of Leicester's defence, and the Brazilian was chinking one way then the other, and then found Martinelli, who linked up beautifully with Granit Xhaka. Martinelli cut inside and found a once again advanced Granit Xhaka, and Xhaka's cleverly improvised first time layoff found Gabriel Jesus, and the rest was history. It was just simply sublime from the Brazilian. With three Leicester defenders around him, our new Brazilian produced a stunning, world-class, lifted curling finish into the far top corner to score his first competitive goal for the Arsenal on his home debut in the Premier League. It was a world-class, curling, lifted finish. It did get a slight nick off Johnny Evans, and it just simply was outstanding. What a finish, what a first goal for Jesus, and we had a deserved 1-0 lead. Another early goal, of course, Martinelli scored in the 19th minute at Selhurst Park in our opening Premier League game of the season. And well, 4 minutes after that, in the 23rd minute this time around, we had the opening goal. The hydration break came seconds after. And well, Leicester were comfortable until Saka set up Xhaka just before that 23rd minute opener. But Brendan Rodgers' men simply fell off the pace and couldn't keep up with us for the remaining few minutes of the first half. Martinelli and Xhaka were excellent in the first half. Our standout performers, with the pair constantly linking up nicely down the left-hand side. Zinchenko was particularly enjoying himself. He really looked as though he was loving life as a left-back slash central midfielder. And well, he looked very comfortable and assured, tucking infield alongside Partey, while Xhaka continued to link up exceptionally well with Martinelli down the left. And well, 12 minutes later, after continued Arsenal dominance, Jesus grabbed his second, and it was no more than we deserved. We were all over and outplayed Leicester from the 20th minute or so, and this time it was Martinelli's in-swinging corner that was flicked on at the near post by none other than Jamie Vardy. And Jesus was lurking to nod home into an empty net, lurking at the far post, a Jamie Vardy assist. And well, it was just going. It was simply getting better and better and better from an Arsenal perspective. And well, 2 minutes later, Jesus really could have had his hat-trick. He was found brilliantly, this time by Ramsdale, from a direct goal kick. And with his back to goal and no one really in support, the 25-year-old held off Johnny Evans brilliantly and sent the Leicester centre-back to the ground. And well, all of a sudden, Jesus was in one-on-one against Ward, and it seemed for all the world that he would grab his hat-trick. But back came a sliding Wilfred Ndidi to deny our new striker a dream first-half Premier League home debut hat-trick. And then 2 minutes later, another Arsenal opportunity. This time, Zinchenko pinched the ball back excellently and fed Odegaard. The Norwegian played a delightful reverse pass to Jesus, who played a perfect 1-2 this time with Martinelli. And well, our Brazilian striker was in again, 1-on-1, but from a tight angle, Ward stood firm and saved well with his legs. And then a hugely controversial moment 3 minutes later, 3 minutes before the half-time interval, and totally against the run of play, Castagna's perfectly weighted pass found Jamie Vardy, who got goal side of Gabriel. And well, Ramsdale came rushing out and appeared to bring down the Leicester striker in real time. But the ref pointed to the spot initially, but a VAR review rightfully overturned the decision. No penalty, and we went into the break with a fully deserved 2-0 lead. And well, Jamie Vardy was rightfully booed by the home support. There was clearly no contact with Aaron Ramsdale, and Ramsdale knew better than that. He's simply not going to make contact with Vardy. Vardy was going away from goal, and with how fast Vardy was running, even a blow on the Leicester striker would have sent him to ground, just the speed at which he was running. And well, at half-time then it was Arsenal 2, Leicester City 0. And it was a slow first 7 or 8 minutes of the second half, but then probably the most frantic of minutes in the whole game. Leicester, out of absolutely nothing, were gifted an unlikely way back into the game 8 minutes into the second half. Johnny Evans' long, hopeful ball found the head of James Justin after Ben White's hesitant defending. Saliba, though, looked completely in control. He was goal side of Vardy. The Frenchman looked set to just calmly nod back to Ramsdale, but the pair didn't communicate in time. Poor communication, and Saliba's headed back pass trickled past the desperate and outstretched Ramsdale. For me, it was Ramsdale's error. Saliba should have been given a shout by Ramsdale. He should have said, "Mine," and the Englishman should have collected easily. And it would have remained at 2-0, but well, listen to this, it was just incredible. We responded exceptionally well. Less than 2 minutes later, another comical goal from a defensive point of view, which gifted us our two-goal advantage once again, seconds after our gift to Leicester. This time, Ben White's cross towards the far post, towards Gabriel Jesus, seemed an easy catch for Danny Ward. But it was Fofana and Ward who got in a tussle and an unforgivable spill right at the feet of an ever-alert Jesus resulted in an easy tap-in for Granit Xhaka. Jesus reacted well to Ward's gift, and our Brazilian striker flicked it into the path of the Swiss midfielder. And of course, Jesus returned the favour to Xhaka after the Swiss international had set up our Brazilian striker for the first goal in the 23rd minute. And well, it was a well-deserved Granit Xhaka goal. And it was just so eye-catching to see how advanced Xhaka was in this newfound attacking role that Arteta has given Granit Xhaka. He's almost like a supporting number 10 almost. Of course, Martin Odegaard was watching Ndidi in the Leicester midfield to prevent Ndidi from spraying passes left and right, and that really stopped Leicester from playing. It was once again brilliant in terms of tactical play by Mikel Arteta. Once again, his tactical approach too good for the opposition. And well, Granit Xhaka was in many ways our Martin Odegaard in our comprehensive home victory. And his easy tap-in gave us a 3-1 lead in the 55th minute. And we looked once again in firm control. No real talking points then until the 67th minute. And a majestic solo run by Jesus eventually got to the byline after breezing past Evans, and from a tight angle, our hungry Brazilian striker shot just wide from a tight angle. But Jesus was really loving life as our new number 9. And then in the 72nd minute, on a swift Arsenal counter-attack, Bukayo Saka found man of the match Jesus just inside the 18-yard box. But the Brazilian's first-time curler went just wide. And then after Kelechi Iheanacho had replaced Jamie Vardy in the 73rd minute, Iheanacho was certainly causing more problems for our defence. And well, Rodgers' men grabbed their second to put themselves right back into the game again, with 16 minutes remaining of normal time, to set up a potentially nerve-wracking final few minutes. They had been giving us a few warning signs for about 5 minutes before their second, with substitute Iheanacho giving the away side a new edge to their play. The Nigerians' clever reverse pass found James Maddison, who made a brilliant run just inside the right-hand side of the 18-yard box. Zinchenko was slightly out of position, and the English playmaker struck low from a tight angle with the ball going through Ramsdale's legs. Our keeper once again could and should have done better to keep out the shot, which wasn't fantastically struck by Maddison, but it was all of a sudden Arsenal 3, Leicester 2, with 15 minutes to go. And it was going to be a nerve-wracking final 15 minutes or so at the Emirates. But once again, our fans were exceptional. They spurned us on again. And well, it was deja vu seconds later. And it was a case of, as they say, deja vu. And we restored our 2-goal advantage once again seconds after a Leicester goal for the second time in the space of 20 second half minutes. And what a goal it was, scored by the simply outstanding Gabriel Martinelli, who notched his second league goal in as many Premier League outings. Our Brazilian started the move by tracking back brilliantly to steal back possession high up the pitch in a dangerous position. Leicester were careless, and the Brazilian fed Saka, who allowed the ball to run towards Odegaard. And then it spelled danger from then on. Odegaard fed that man again, Jesus, who was everywhere, alongside Xhaka. It was incredible. Xhaka and Jesus, it seemed as though they weren't really told to stick to a specific position. They were both all over the pitch on Saturday afternoon. And then the former Man City man laid it off to Martinelli, who let fly unexpectedly, perhaps with his weaker left foot, from the edge of the area. And he caught it sublimely, and the ball flew past a helpless Ward to restore our 2-goal advantage. Another goal, another Martinelli goal, and a second Gabriel Jesus assist. Incredible. And well, it seemed as though then in the 75th minute, 4-2 to the good, it seemed as though that was enough. 5 minutes later then, Jesus was inches away from a home debut Premier League hat-trick once again. This time Martinelli was involved in more world-class play, this time chesting a throw-in into the path of Saka. Saka's low drive was parried well by Ward, but only into the path of the awaiting Jesus. And with the goal gaping, our hungry, ever enthusiastic new signing could only push a left-footed shot that struck the outside of the post into the side netting. And so unlucky, Jesus there. Every single Arsenal supporter in the Emirates Stadium was wishing that ball into the back of the net. And then 5 minutes later, Thomas Partey was so unlucky not to score from a corner. His quick, smart swivel inside the 6-yard box allowed him to volley towards goal, only for his well-worked shot to cannon off the post. And well, it did stay at 4-2. And there were late cameo appearances from Kieran Tierney, who replaced Zinchenko at left back. Tomiyasu came on for Ben White at right back. And then Nketiah and Emil Smith-Rowe replaced the brilliant Jesus and Bukayo Saka. A memorable afternoon at the Emirates then, on what was our first Premier League home fixture of the new Premier League season. Jesus scored 2 and provided 2 assists. And well, a simply outstanding performance from the Gunners. It finished at the Emirates on Saturday afternoon. Arsenal 4, Leicester City 2.
What lengths would you go to watch a match? Well, the answer being any. Get this, a Turkish man, we haven't got his name, a diehard fan of Denizlispor Football Club. He wouldn't be denied his chance to see his team after being banned for a year. We don't know the reasons. Was it chickens again? Anyway, he hired a crane and parked it outside the stadium to allow him uninterrupted coverage and views of the home games. But there's a drawback. It's a long way down to the burger van. That's dedication for you, Turkish styly. Afarin to you, sir. What? Oh, it means well done, Dave. Now, if you've listened to the pod before, you will know our exact and precise feelings about the half and half scarf. What about a half and half shirt? What about a half and half shirt combining Arsenal and Tottenham? What? It sends shivers down the spine, makes me feel a bit poorly, but it did actually appear. What say you, Dave? I can't repeat that. I can repeat that one. Absolute Contes. Now, I don't even care what the reason is. I don't care how you explain it away. It's a non-runner, a non-event, a non-starter. It's a shirt for idiots and tossers. Don't even come to me with it's a collector's item. There's no excuse for it. There's no need for it. It's like steak covered in blancmange or cheese on your Cheerios.
It's an Arsenal thing. It's an Arsenal thing. Believe it or not, it's an Arsenal thing. With football and transfers, you know who you'll bring. You're listening to It's an Arsenal Thing.
Jamie O'Hara on Squawk Sport seemed confident enough that Spurs are going to have a stellar season. I'm not sure what he bases that on. Just have a listen to this.
With the players that we've signed...
So who are you going to overtake? You're not going to catch Liverpool, are you? Let's be honest about that.
I'm not sure.
You think you're going to catch Liverpool? Liverpool?
I'm optimistic. I'm optimistic.
I know you are. But if you had to put your...
No, I wouldn't put my house on
right.
it.
Right, okay, that's what I'm saying. So right now...
But I look at the squad of players that we've signed, and we've got a brilliant manager. So now's the time where you got to say, right...
You can overtake Liverpool.
I think we can have a go at Liverpool next season.
So you think you can overtake Liverpool?
I think we can win a trophy.
Can you overtake Liverpool?
I don't know. I'm saying we could have a go. I think we're going to be a
you
lot...
You said you catch them!
I think we can be a lot closer than people, making...
Can you overtake Liverpool?
I don't know. Stop trying to put words in my mouth.
No, you said you're going to catch them. What does catcher mean?
Well, I think we can get close to them. I think we can win a trophy. I'm telling you now, if we finish fourth, Chase,
yep.
behind Liverpool, Man City and Chelsea, I'm not going to be sat here as a happy Spurs fan.
Okay, what will make you happy? Carabao Cup.
Third and a trophy.
Carabao Cup? Fourth and Carabao. Come on, mate. You haven't got a trophy, but...
Yeah, I'll take fourth for Carabao.
You're going to take that.
I'll take fourth for Carabao.
He's going to take the Papa John's trophy.
Let's go to Woody, who's an Arsenal fan. Woody, good evening.
Now, it's been years, absolute yonks, since Arsenal had a genuine ginger player. Not since the heady days of Ray Parlour and Willie Young have we had a proper ginge. Holding's taken away our only chance of baldness. Terry Mancini was our last one, I think. Let's get some ginger and slap in this squad. Now, when we asked our glorious podcast family to come up with a top five list of gingers, you didn't disappoint. Perry Groves, Ray Parlour, Igor Stepanovs, John Hartson, Willie Young and Alan Ball. The results are from 5-1. And at 5, it's Willie Young from 1977 to 81. At 4, it's Alan Ball from 1971 to 86. At 3, it's John Hartson, 1995 to 97. At 2, it's Perry Groves, 86 to 92. And at 1, it had to be the Romford Pele, Ray Parlour, 92 to 2004.
Benjamin White, not Ben. He likes Benjamin, is key to the Arsenal team. Benjamin White, not Ben. He likes Benjamin, as fit as a guard dog's flea. He's good with his head. He's good with his knees. The pin-up defender that's eager to please. Benjamin White, not Ben. He likes Benjamin. He's key to the Arsenal team.
Right, let's have a quick roundup of footy facts for the inquisitive. What's the oldest football club in the country? No, it's not that one. Notts County. Records show they played matches as early as the 28th of November 1862, meaning that they are officially recognised as the oldest club still playing football in the Football League. What's the most unusual football club name in the UK? How about Keith? Sounds like a neighbour. I'm just popping round Keith's to borrow his socket set. Keith Football Club are a senior football club who currently play in the Highland League in Scotland. They were founded in 1910 and play in Keith, unsurprisingly, which is in Moray, Scotland. What's the longest football club name in the UK? Well, Google has it as Inverness Caledonian Thistle. That's not even close to the length of a club name in New Zealand. Check this out. The sound quality is a bit sketchy, but here we go.
Let's try this again.
Let's not. Who'd be a commentator out there? It's so long, it has to be abbreviated into Tawamata FC New Zealand.
There's a challenge for Connor and Lauren. Connor, what you got?
Tama tafa katangi hanga kauau tama teuturi puka apik iman gahoro nuku poikai wen yuak itana tahu.
Oh yes, literally rolls off the tongue. Lauren, how'd you get on?
Okay, we're on to attempt number, I don't know, I can't remember. I'm sitting in a public place, everyone thinks I've lost my mind. I'm sitting here saying this word over and over again. Tamata waka tangi hanga kawawao. Tamate pakao wanao kai tana tahu. Oh dear, I'm so sorry.
Brilliant. By the way, what they just said literally translates into the summit where Tamate, the man with the big knees, the slider, climber of mountains, the land swallower, who travelled about, played his nose flute to his loved one. Courtesy of 442.com.
It's time to enter the gunroom for a natter.
Hi, welcome to the gun room. It's an upbeat gun room. It's a full gun room as well. Look at me. I'm surrounded. I've got Mitch back. How are you, Mitch?
Great. Great to be back.
We've got Paul. How are you, Paul?
Fine, Tom, and thanks for inviting me back for the second week.
Hey, no problem at all, mate. We need your unbiased opinion. And we've got Jay, the superstar of All or Nothing. We're just talking about him. How are you, mate?
All good.
What's it like under the staircase?
It's always fun.
For our podcast family, Jay's missus is a Leicester supporter, and he was giving his opinion about what the score was last week. So invariably, he's been given bread and water under the staircase.
Yeah.
Chaps, we've got a lot to discuss. I mean, I've got reams and reams and reams of paper here that we could bring into play. But first off, 30 years ago, it was the inception of the Premier League. Just got a quick one for you. Guess what who was in bottom slot back then in 1992? Manchester United. And just above them was Arsenal. So it all comes around, doesn't it? Hey, people who mocked you, they get their comeuppance in the end. Thierry Henry's birthday as well. We'll celebrate that. The big man, the king. Premier League superstar. Oh, first off, I was just doing a piece on Arsene Wenger, and he's been in the news quite a lot lately. I just thought I'd quickly tell everyone his first ever lineup, which was David Seaman, Lee Dixon, Tony Adams, Steve Bould, Mike Keown, Nigel Winterburn, Paul Merson, David Platt, Patrick Vieira, John Hartson, and Ian Wright. I mean, that floods the memory. I don't know about you, Mitch. You're about 12, aren't you, really? But
I just had my 13th birthday yesterday, and so really, I don't know any of these players.
And he's had a haircut as well. Very aerodynamic. Right, let's get on. Leicester at the Emirates. What did you make of it, Jay? I'm so buzzed up. It was one of those performances. We are that type of podcast. We don't always have to win, although we'd like to. But it's all about performances. What did you make of that?
Yeah, it was a great performance. Atmosphere seemed great inside the stadium, and the players buzzed off that. So much to enjoy about the performance. Wasn't perfect. Still many elements of the team and the performance, you know, that can be improved and worked on. But all in all, it was a performance full of fluid position, interchangeable positions, and it was great to see the players enjoying their football. You know, Leicester came and you know what I said last week, I thought it was going to be a tough game, and it proved to be a tough game. You know, Leicester did bring it to us in the first half, especially tight at times. You know, Leicester had a couple of chances, but we played some lovely stuff, full of energy, and yeah, enjoyed the performance.
Best one for a while.
I think from an attacking point of view, obviously, I'm sure we'll go into Gabriel Jesus and what he's brought to the team. But his energy and his off the ball movement and his quick feet and his ability to move across the line and pick the ball up in areas and drive and off the ball running, he's brought so much to the team already. So I think from an attacking point of view, definitely that was one of the most exciting performances that I've seen for a while. Yeah,
Paul, what did you make of it? Did you see it?
Yeah, I was.
He's on an Arsenal podcast.
Obviously, I haven't watched the whole game, but I did watch the highlights on Match of the Day at the weekend. And I completely reinforced the points Jay's been making there. I think I said last week on the podcast that I think Gabriel Jesus has just been a fantastic signing for Arsenal. And it's not just his goal-scoring ability. It's the way he links up with the rest of the attackers, the way he's an outlet ball for the midfield all the time, the way he creates space for others. And if he's not scoring himself, then he's creating opportunities for the players as well. So that's a really, really valuable asset for any team to have. And also, he's the type of player, you would know better than me, that lifts the crowd. And you need someone to lift the crowd, to get the crowd on side. I think he's made a real impact in that regard as well. And I mean, looking at his goals, I mean, the first one was a fabulous chip into the corner of the nest. And the second one's a tap-in. And forwards get tap-ins. It doesn't always have to be a spectacular goal. So right place, right time, took the opportunity, reacted well. He was involved in the build-up as well for the third goal, which lets his keeper make the mistake. So, for a new signing to come in after two games and already look like he played in that role for Arsenal all his life, I think it is a massive plus. If I was being slightly negative, I would just say I still have a slight concern about Ramsdale and goal. I think he was definitely to blame for the second goal. And it's kind of quite ironic, isn't it? We praised Saliba last week, and it was an unfortunate little goal. But once again, I thought Ramsdale should have taken responsibility there, because the goalie can see what's going on behind. It's up to him to call and direct the defender. But apart from that, if I'd have been you guys, I'd have been delighted with the performance. Two games, two wins, joint top of the table. What more do you want?
Hey, Mitch, we haven't had a chance to talk to you about Jesus. That front line now is looking super exciting, isn't it? Martinelli, Saka and Jesus. What did you make of their performance generally as an attacking force? And are we kind of getting carried away, Mitch?
I mean, there's a lot to be excited about with this front line. And I think Jesus really just ties it all together in a way that Lacazette couldn't, because of his kind of one-dimensionality with dropping deep, linking play, not really doing much else. We're getting a lot more dynamic movement from Jesus, which is helping Martinelli by a byproduct. And I mean, we could have seen a little bit of a slow start from Saka and Odegaard on the right side, but like, we aren't relying on them. Our left side dynamics have been like a world of difference so far this season, and I think a huge part of that has been Jesus. He's kind of popping up those areas. He and Martinelli are rotating, like where Martinelli will pop up in central positions and Jesus will pop up on the left and even on the right. It creates this really, really interesting fluidity that is really, really hard to defend against. And then we're even seeing deeper with Zinchenko and Xhaka, where they're kind of rotating in their positions. So when you have this positional fluidity, it makes it really, really difficult to stop Arsenal. We look unpredictable. We're scoring goals, six goals in two games to start the year. World of difference from last last season, where we had zero goals to start the first two games. So I mean, Jesus obviously is the star of the show. He had four GA in the Leicester game. But I mean, the dynamics that he's created with Martinelli and with Saka has been really, really fun to watch, because our attacking dynamics are completely different than they were last season, and we're seeing the effects from it.
I'll tell you what I am a little bit troubled about. I mean, things looking good. We've always got to find something, haven't we, to have a bit of interest and a bit of chat about. ESR, how hard has that boy got to work to get back in this side now? Because the way it's shaping up, there's not an obvious space, is there? What do you make of that, Jay? Can we get him back in? Is he going to be happy with doing this occasional sort of guesting slot?
He needs to stay fit more than anything. He's I don't think ability I don't think ability is even in question. I mean, it's healthy competition, to have good players in a number of positions. But it's for him, it's all about fitness, and if he can stay fit, I'm sure there's going to be plenty of games for everybody to get their minutes. He's a key member of the team. He might not be, it was only a year or so ago where Odegaard wasn't in the team and he wasn't playing week in, week out. And now we all consider him, obviously he's a captain, but we consider him to be a key member of the first team, you know, the starting 11. So I don't think there's anything to worry about. I don't think he will be too concerned. I think he's just, you know, everybody knows he's just got to stay fit. He's got to get fit first. He's got to stay fit. You know, we can't forget how many, you know, how heavily he contributed to the team last year. You know, he scored plenty of goals and he was a massive member of that good period, sort of the second third of the season. So he's got to work hard. And obviously the longer the team does well, it's going to be harder for Mikel to get him into the starting 11, you know, but I'm sure, you know, Smith Rowe's not stupid. He'll know that, you know, if the team's doing well, he's either got to rely on an injury or a dip in form in the team. And let's hope there's no dip in form with the team. You know, we need to keep this consistency up. It's been a great start. He's not going to be, I mean, there's nothing to worry about from, I don't think, he's just got to get fit.
Paul, there was a number of really good performances there, but the one I'm really interested in is Granit Xhaka. It was like a man possessed. He was like a centre forward at one stage. I was like, who is this guy? They he's been abducted by aliens. They've swapped him over. What did you make of his performance? Because I haven't seen a Granit Xhaka like that since whenever.
Probably since he first signed for Arsenal, Tom. Yeah, I guess. I mean, I already comment on the highlights I've seen, so I'm probably not going to give a true reflection of his performance. But you know, once again, he's in the right place at the right time to score the third goal. And you know, I think if there's an occasion, the way he's been since towards the end of last season, starts of this season, because I thought he played really well at Crystal Palace as well. He led by example in that game as well. And he's kind of making a strong case that if Odegaard is out injured and can't be captain, he could step back up and pick up his form of role again as captain of the team. But yeah, I mean, it's been quite a transformation in his attitude and his performance now. You know, whether you could say that's linked with the World Cup coming up when he wants to make sure his performance is merit selection for the national team. I don't know, but it's definitely a factor in a lot of players' minds this season that they're really going to push in the first half of the season to make sure they get picked for their national teams. But and you know, I'm sure you lot as Arsenal fans, you know, are delighted with the transformation in attitude, in his contribution to the team, and also you know, he's scoring goals now as well. So you know, for your midfield players, that's what you want, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Mitch, we'll talk about the documentary series All or Nothing, but Xhaka has kind of been portrayed in a different sort of light. What have you made of the way that he's coming across?
Yeah, I mean, I think over the last year has kind of been a transformational process for Xhaka's image in the eyes of Arsenal fans. Like he's had more chances where he's given interviews, given his side of situations and stuff like that. So we've gotten a much bigger look into like his thought process about things, like how he carries himself, both as a professional and as a player. And seeing that in All or Nothing kind
Mitch,
of
can I just say as well, he's got a very hot wife.
Sure. like a lot of players. He's been able to show like who he really is rather than like the 90 minutes that we see of him a week. And so when you have this image of a player, because you just watch him for 90 minutes, you don't see like, I don't know, you don't see these like gentle moments of Xhaka where he's like with his daughters. It's a much different person because it's an actual person as opposed to this like just player that's on the field. So, you know, you get a much different look. And I think, I mean, his role has changed a lot in the last year, which I think has changed his image in the eyes of fans a lot. I mean, we saw a very different Xhaka, or we've seen a very different Xhaka to start the year with these last two matches. And I think the, like, kind of what I was saying with, like, the left side dynamics changing a lot and becoming a lot more effective, I think, like, Martinelli playing better and Zinchenko being there has helped Xhaka a lot in terms of being able to go further forward. I think we have this like this 2-3-5 like build up, but I feel like it was like a 4.5 up top. Xhaka was never really fully occupying that left half space. We saw that a lot last weekend of him fully within that left half space, across the attacking line. Like, he's up against the defenders, and we hadn't seen that. And so it allows for him to be in that position to pounce on that third goal. And so, I mean, same with Smith Rowe, that we've got a lot of different options at midfield. We've been like heavily linked with Youri Tielemans for 8 months now. And like, it's getting to a point where it's like, well, I can see why the club are kind of taking their time on this and like not really rushing themselves on it, because we've got both Smith Rowe and Fabio Vieira coming back who can play those roles. We've got Jocko's playing really well. We've got Sambi in his second season. We got Odegaard, obviously. Like, we have a lot of different players that can play these roles. And that's really good, because like, I guarantee you, Xhaka has seen all the talk of, oh, the club is probably looking to upgrade his position. He probably knows the club has been heavily looking at Youri Tielemans, and that probably motivates a competitor like Xhaka to be like, all right, well, I'm going to be that player in that position. I think it's really funny that when he was signed, Wenger described him as a box-to-box midfielder, and everyone kind of was like, what are you talking about? And now he's like truly playing that role. It's like become this like full circle thing where the beginning of his career, that's what he, like, Wenger saw him as, and now he's in that role and doing a great job of it. So hopefully it continues, but it'll be interesting to see how the future of the position shakes out just through this season and into next, with all the different players that we have at the disposal that can play in those places.
Jay, is it purely a case of Xhaka never got the opportunity to play his natural game, or the game that he would prefer to play, because of the elements around him that they weren't as strong? So he had to play a slightly different, more defensive role. Now we've got Zinchenko and people like that. He's coming to the fore. You know, we've got to take this easy. We can't just say on the back of one game and one particularly good performance. But do you think that his game is now about to evolve because the team has changed so much?
Yeah, well, it started last season, didn't it, where he was a bit more advanced. He was playing a little bit more further forward, and he was getting into areas that he hadn't previously, you know, he wouldn't go into. And he was slightly more... slightly deeper, because we didn't have the players, you know, that we have now. We all have a different opinion on Xhaka, you know, like, he's, you know, keep in mind, you know, first and foremost, the All or Nothing documentary is, you know, the documentary in general is great at showing the more human side of footballers, and the fact that they're affected by not just the players, but the manager, and, you know, the way that they're affected by criticism. And it's great from that point of view. And it was, you know, it's great that they focused on Xhaka and they went into his house and met his wife and saw that side of him. And you live in hope that, you know, supporters don't, you know, if he does get sent off, or if he does do something silly, and I suspect this applies to any of the players, if they do similar, that supporters don't hammer him as much and attack them, because they are obviously humans as well. Xhaka in general, I think he's playing as well as he's played for us since we signed him, and long may it continue. I still think we can upgrade. I still think there are better players out there, but I think it's not just from a technical point that, you know, Arteta likes his physical presence and his leadership skills. And that's a big part of that centre midfield, because I don't think you get that with Thomas Partey. You don't get that leadership with Thomas Partey. And I think Arteta leans on Xhaka from that point of view. So, look, I hope it continues. He's a good player. Everybody's known he's a good player. He's been sent off, and he's let the team down on so many, you know, so many times that sometimes, you know, you can't always just let go of that. Look, he's playing well, and long may it continue. And I think he's also, like Mitch said, we haven't pursued Tielemans. We haven't signed another centre midfielder, probably because of the improvement we've seen from Xhaka. And maybe, I don't know. I'm still I'm hopeful that we can bring someone else in. Maybe not this window, but, you know, ultimately long term, I think he is his position is somewhere where we can definitely improve on still, even though he's playing well. Long may it continue. And on Saturday against Leicester, that was as good as I've seen him play. So fair play.
Right, let's talk about that Leicester game. We went in with a 4-2-3-1. It was Aaron Ramsdale, Ben White, Willow Saliba, I like to call him, Gabriel, Zinchenko, Thomas Partey, Xhaka, Saka, Martin Odegaard, Gabriel Martinelli, and Gabriel Jesus. We do like a Gabriel, don't we? We just like collecting them. What's your name, Gabriel? Oh, come and get contract with Arsenal. Paul, let's have a look at Leicester first before we get into the crux of the game. Myself and Jay and you were talking about there seems to be a kind of weird sort of vibe. Even when Brendan Rodgers came on for the interview afterwards, there seemed to be a lack of something. There's something going on at the club. They've got the money. They don't have to sell players. They were FA Cup winners and Premier League winners not so long ago. What's going on down there? It just seems like there's a null and void vibe down there.
Yeah, I mean, I can't quite get to the bottom of what's going on with Leicester because, as you say, I think they've got quite a capable and talented manager, and Brendan Rodgers, I think his record speaks for itself, you know, both at that other team across Stanley Park, the team in Glasgow, and, you know, at Leicester as well. So, yeah, I think they've got a proven manager there with a proven record at the top level. There's some really good players in that squad still. You know, I think it's often James Maddison's goal. You know, he's always going to be a threat, but there's... You know, if you concede them 4 goals away from home in your first away game of the season, now, as a Leicester fan, that raises questions straight away, doesn't it? I think letting Kasper Schmeichel go might prove to be a bit of a misjudgment because you saw that Danny Ward simply was not up to the level that Schmeichel has set out Leicester for a number of seasons. And you can't survive in the Premier League without the top keeper. And I just don't think Danny Ward is the answer in that respect for Leicester. I think as well, because even when they won the league, the following season, that's solid. They sold Kante to Chelsea, so even though they were league champions, they were still a selling club. And I think part of Leicester's problems might be they still have the mentality of a selling club. And, you know, if they were to lose Fofana to Chelsea, if they were to lose Maddison to Newcastle, then you really, and if Tielemans were to join Arsenal, then you do wonder how they're going to get through the season. I still think they've got enough about them to survive, but I think if they scraped into the top half of the table, that would be quite an achievement in the circumstances. I don't know what the financial situation is less at the moment. I don't know if they've overspent and they haven't got money to spare. But in terms of falls from grace, I'm kind of compared to Blackburn Rovers in 1994-95 when they won the league but never left a legacy. Same for Leicester City. They won the league but they never pushed on from winning the league. Even now, 6-7 seasons later, they're kind of still paying the price of that. And there just seems to be a mindset about the club that at the moment, that they're quite happy to kind of move around in mid-table with the odd cup run, which, you know, given their history, might not be that bad an outcome. But given where they were within the league title, you'd kind of expect a bit more from them.
Absolutely. Mitch, there was some standout performances. We'll get to the goals and various bits and pieces. What did you make of Martinelli's performance? I was particularly impressed because he was up against Fofana, and there's been a lot said about him being a stellar defender. Well, I thought he put him in his pocket.
Yeah, I think it was one of Martinelli's best performances in an Arsenal shirt, without a doubt. He was absolutely phenomenal. Gabriel Jesus had 4 goals and assists, but I still think Martinelli was the best player on the pitch. He was just...
Oh, you've blown it now. We can't get him out of the match now.
he was just relentless. He, like you were talking about, Fofana is a really, really good player. There's a reason that Leicester wants so much money for him. There's a reason Chelsea's willing to pay that much money for him. And Martinelli made him look horrendous. And I think that's just a testament to how good Martinelli can be. And I think it's something that I've noticed with him is he plays up to his competition a lot. He plays to the level of the competition a lot. He will tend to like go up against really, really tough opponents and play really well. Like some of his best performances last season were against Man City, against Liverpool. Like he plays up to his competition really, really well. But then, you know, North London Derby at the end of last season, he was going up against Emerson Royale and like Eric Dyer, and he wasn't that effective. So that's something I would like to see some improvement on, because like when he plays against really, really good players like Fofana, like Robin, well, I guess not Robertson, because I would be defending Saka, but like Trent Alexander-Arnold, and he plays up against really, really good teams. And we saw a lot of that this weekend. And I'm really glad that he got a goal, because he absolutely deserved some sort of offensive output from that kind of performance. He was really, really good.
I'll tell you what, as well, he's looking like the player that we had before he got the injury. I think it was against Liverpool, wasn't it? And he was out for quite a long spell. Jay, let's get to Gabriel Jesus. Phenomenal home debut. Everyone's been banging on about it, and we're going to do the same. We're not original. We don't claim to be. But it was a wicked performance, wasn't it? Talk us through that first goal. I mean, that was an exceptional goal as a striker yourself, former striker, obviously. Haven't got the legs for it now, have you, mate?
Not at all.
Not
for many years.
Talk us through that goal and what it takes to get it.
Yeah, you got to refresh my memory now. Was it Shaka? Did he take the ball into the box and did he lay it back?
It kind of pinged about, wasn't it? It was Martinelli, yeah. It was Xhaka and Jesus in interplay.
He was sort of as the way the camera was. He was on the sort of the far side of the 18 yard box, and he no backlift, Bergkamp-esque, wasn't it, from sort of Pete Bergkamp years, and he used the defenders, Jesus did, to sort of bend the ball, and it just dropped lovely into the back of the net, and more than deserved it. More than anything, the Jesus performance, he just looks like he's enjoying his football. He looks like he's maybe playing for Pep. I don't know I wouldn't say it was too much for him, because he obviously contributed heavily, but it looks like there's a bit of weight's been lifted off his shoulders, and he's just been told by Arteta just to go out there and enjoy yourself. And you're the main man, you're our top striker, you're going to play.
Do you think Pep swamped him with tactical sort of nonsense rather? And obviously, he wasn't the main man, he was part of a very successful team. Do you think that's another factor as well?
I think maybe. Maybe not from a tactical point of view, but just maybe he didn't feel that Pep truly believed in him to lead the line properly, because he wasn't always, well, he didn't feature as their main striker too often, did he? You know, and obviously they went out and signed Haaland. Haaland, I'm sure, will go on to be an absolute world star for years to come. But, you know, if you were to look at their starts to the season, Haaland's had a good start, and so is Jesus. You know, there's not too much difference between them at the minute. So, I mean, lovely first goal. You know, the way he turned, was it Johnny Evans in the second half, where could have had it? I mean, that is just, we haven't seen that at the club for quite a while. You know, Aubameyang, he had pace, but Aubameyang would rarely do that, where he would roll defenders back into the defender and roll him. And Jesus isn't the tallest. And Johnny Evans is an old school defender, you know, he's going to be snarling and all over, and he just rolled in perfectly, in on goal. He's technically so good, you know, his touches in and around the box, and he's a good footballer as well as a very good forward, and he also comes across so well on camera. And he's a humble guy, and he's just slotted perfectly into the team. But, you know, lovely goal. I don't know about, obviously, this doesn't apply to you, Paul, but I don't know what you guys think. He's done better than I expected him to do so far. You know, I knew he was a good striker, but I didn't think he was this good, you know, I love the performance. It was just a throwback to Thierry, you know, how quick.
Bergkamp and Thierry Henry, the same podcast, Jay. What's in that drink you've got? Unbelievable. Yeah. No, it is very impressive. Paul, well, let's talk about the second goal. It was, he's got a sort of a different way of doing things, isn't he, Jesus? He can score with his head. He can score the stunning goals. He can score the tap-ins. That's the variety that he brings. This one was off the head of Vardy. He was just poaching, wasn't he, really? And that's what Arsenal have missed, something of a poacher.
Yeah, I think it's something most teams miss from time to time. But yeah, I mean, it's the anticipation, it's the reaction, it's being in the right place at the right time. It's also finding the space to make the header, because, you know, as I recall, he's not particularly tightly marked either. So, you know, it's a classic poacher's goal. You're in the right place, the ball goes across, you react first, you're 2 yards away from goal, you tap it over the line, it's a goal. You don't need to score a 30-yard spectacular one week in, week out. And I agree with what Jay's saying there, you know, the way he links the play with the rest of the team, the way he makes space for himself, and also he excites the crowd. You know, nothing like more as a supporter is to see the opposition centre-half being turned inside out by a pacey forward. And I can see. No, I mean, I guess compared to the attack that was starting last season, Jesus supports a different dimension. You know, he's an instant crowd favourite already. And I think that just gives the whole club a lift. And I think, I mean, I said that on the podcast last week, I thought he was an excellent signing for Arsenal. You know, when I saw him playing for Man City, you know, You made the point about Pep there, Jay, and I think as well. You know, I don't think Guardiola kind of built the team around Jesus' strengths particularly, but I think Arteta has kind of learned from that, has kind of, you know, tried to get the balls to Jesus, get the balls to his base, get him to think of the rest of the team, and make him the star player, because I think if you want to play, strive on confidence. So in Gabriel Jesus' case, you know, if you've gone from being from battling to get in the team to being told by the manager, your name's first on the team sheet, I want you to respond by scoring goals for me. Well, so far, he's repaid the manager's faith. And I think, out of all the summer signings, I know Haaland's been the big name, but it'll be interesting to see at the end of the season which of those two finishes with the highest tally of goals.
Mitch, we've brought in Zinchenko and Jesus. Obviously, we're going on about Jesus's goal input and all that sort of thing, but two proven winners been bought in from Manchester City that we didn't expect to get to. Has that had a major effect on the dynamic? Do you see that as a major reason where we're kind of pushing ahead now as opposed to last season?
Yeah, I think this kind of fades into something like that Jay mentioned that I wanted to talk about, which is, like, I think that there's been like a clear difference between both of their roles within Manchester City and within now. And despite how good of a manager Pep Guardiola is, I do think that his system can prove to be a little bit tactically rigid when it comes to certain players. Like we've seen these two players now leave the system, and they're playing with a lot of fluidity, playing with a lot of depth in their style. And we've also seen a player that played similarly go into their system and become kind of boring and rigid in Jack Grealish, who I've talked about on this spot before. I'm a huge fan of the player. I do think he's going to take a big step this season after spending 1 year in Pep's system. But I think that there's a sense of rigidness and like not allowing players to truly play to their strengths if it goes outside of the tactical strengths. And we're seeing the freedom that Zinchenko and Jesus have now in this Arsenal system, where, like I was talking about earlier, they're fluid in their positional play. They're not standing in one place. They're not like making sure. I think there's clear influences of positional play that Arteta takes into account, but I don't think it's as tactically rigid as Pep's, where, you know, you can only be this amount of players on the width of the pitch and this amount of players vertically on the pitch. Like, that's kind of like there's like these 18 zones that you're going to stay individually in each one. We've seen a lot more flowing in and out, really nice interplays between these players. And I think that we're, we have an opportunity to see the best out of these two really, really talented players. I mean, like, we haven't talked really much about Zinchenko, but like Kyle Walker said when he was on the team that Zinchenko is one of the three highest technical quality players in the entire Manchester City squad, which is a huge thing to say about a left back when you have players like Kevin De Bruyne and Riyad Mahrez and Raheem Sterling, and he's up there with the best of them. And as a left back, like I think we have a real opportunity to see him in a variety of different roles and with a lot of fluidity in his play. And just like Jesus, hopefully really, really flourish like we have seen in the last couple of games.
Paul, I just thought I'd point out this this picture up here. Where is it? There. Remember that?
I can't recall.
It's Steve McMahon. 1 minute.
Oh, Steve McMahon, please don't.
Yeah, I put that on the wall for you, Paul. We could all relive and rub that in the wound.
Do you have any darts available?
Let's get on to the two goals that they scored, because we kind of nicked in front, didn't we, after a minute or so of them scoring. But let's have a look at those two goals. William Saliba at fault for that. I thought Ben White could have done a little bit more when he was kind of tracking back. It was an odd one, wasn't it? Straight over the top. Saliba, if he hadn't have done what he did, Jay, he would have allowed Vardy to get through for sure, wouldn't he?
Yeah, I think I think just having somebody of playing against somebody of Vardy's quality puts that little bit of doubt in your mind, doesn't it? You know, he's always buzzing around. He's a pain in the arse, isn't he? To be perfectly honest,
not as much as his wife.
And I think Paul, you touched on it earlier. I think Ramsdale maybe could have helped out a bit more. Could have spoke to him, or just told him just to clear it, because there was, I mean, I don't know if you guys picked up on it. What I've liked about Saliba's start to the season is that, you know, I've noticed that when he needs to clear the ball, he just clears it. He doesn't try to overcomplicate things too much. And if he needs to put it out, you know, the old school Rose Ed, but, you know, he won't overcomplicate things too much, and he won't try and find a pass. If he needs to kick it out, we'll kick it out. And on that occasion, I think he overthought it, whereas he should have just put it out, even for a corner or whatever. But I do think he could have done with a bit more help from the goalkeeper. But I said last week, it will be a test this week. Obviously, the Leicester game, playing against Vardy, because he's even at the age he's at, he's still as good as they come in this league. And I think the fact that it was Vardy that he was up against just put that little bit of doubt into the back of his head. And I mean, to be honest, I think he still had a good game, Saliba. I think he still didn't let it bother him. I thought the crowd reaction was brilliant in the stadium, the way that they all, you know, clapped and cheered him, cheered Saliba. And you know what? It was a bad own goal, but I don't think it bothered him too much, in the sense I still think he put in a decent performance.
Paul, I'm going to skip you for a sec and go to Mitch, to talk about the second error, which was Madison put it under Jamie Vardy. He should have done better with that, shouldn't he? I'm a big Ramsdale fan, I've got to admit, but that was a real schoolboy job.
Yeah, it's an issue that we're seeing a lot with Ramsdale, and it's with his near post. Like, he's a fantastic goalkeeper, like, really, really good shot stopper, and just excellent with his feet. Like, we were talking about that Jesus turn on Johnny Evans. I mean, Ramsdale hit a crazy ball to get it there. Like, a decent performance in that part of his game on the ball for last weekend. But the shot stopping part, obviously, on the Saliba own goal, I think he had a chance where he could have had something to stop that. And then on this one, definitely getting megged near post is not what you want as a goalkeeper. That's one of those goals that sticks with you. and so I think that it's clearly something that the coaching staff knows about. This is clearly something that Ramsdale knows about. The coaching staff knows about. It's something that he's going to improve on, but it's something that is concerning to see. And I think we're seeing opposition's target a lot more. Like, we saw Madison go towards the byline and take a shot as opposed to trying to put a ball across, because Ramsdale tends to be a little bit weaker on his near post. And I think that that's, as an attacker playing against Arsenal, that's something you're going to keep in mind. And you're like, a near post shot usually isn't what you want. But if it's against Ramsdale, he's traditionally struggled with that, I would have a better chance of scoring that. So that's something that we need to keep an eye on. Definitely need to be critical of when it comes to Ramsdale. Still a very, very good keeper. He's still only 23, 24. He's a baby in goalkeeper years. He's going to improve. This is not an end product by any means when it comes to Aaron Ramsdale. But yeah, not a great goal to concede. Something that needs to be paid attention to and worked on from him.
Mitch, do you think it's a case of when he came to us, he was like the breath of fresh air, wasn't he? He was like, even he couldn't have thought that he would depose Leno of the number one slot, which he did. Now he's got all that pressure. He is the number one and has been theoretically the number one for some time. Has that had an effect on his game?
I don't think so. I think one thing that we can pull from All or Nothing is that he's in general a very confident guy in his abilities. He's very critical of his own abilities as well. Like we saw in, I think it was Aston Villa, we had the late goal at the end when we were already up 3-0. He comes into the changing room pissed off. And like, that's the kind of mentality you want from a goalkeeper, where you're mad about losing the clean sheet, but you still won the game 3-1. Like, still a great performance, and he still played really well, but he's mad about losing the clean sheet. Like, that's a kind of mentality that's like, isn't going to be like, all right, well, I'm the starter and Leno's gone, so I don't really need to care anymore. Like, he's got clear aspirations where he wants to be one of the best goalkeepers in England. He wants to be one of the best goalkeepers in the world. He obviously, like every single player this year, is gunning for a spot starting in a World Cup. And he's got fierce competition in Jordan Pickford, who's been that guy for England for years. And so Ramsdale has to start, like, have these performances where he's putting in consistently. And he knows this. He's a competitor. He's going to actively try to. If any player gets into a starting position and is like, all right, great, my position's safe, I can just coast. They are not built for Arsenal. They're not built for the Premier League, quite frankly. They're probably just not built for professional sports. There is constant pressure from people behind you, from loftier aspirations, rather than just playing week in and week out. So I think Ramsdale's too much of a competitor to, at least from our perspective of what we know about him, for him to be sitting back and coasting because he's just the starter. And he doesn't have any loftier expectations for himself other than that.
Well, as I say, there were two talking points. One was the Saliba goal, own goal, and the other was the Vardy penalty. Paul, what do you make of that?
Yeah, well, it's still a debate these days, isn't it, about what constitutes a penalty and what doesn't. I mean, I only saw a very brief on Match of the Day, so I think Leicester had a strong case that there might have been a penalty there. But you know, these days you can never quite be sure what decision the officials all are going to come together with and decide to is appropriate. So from a Leicester point of view, I think they were just themselves quite unlucky not to have got a penalty there, and whether that would have changed the balance of the game or not, I don't know. But I hate to trot out the old phrase that over the course of the season, these things kind of level themselves out. And maybe they do, maybe I think less and less they do these days, to be honest. But it could have been quite decisive. But either way, even if it had been given, I don't think it affected the outcome of the result. I think Arsenal have enough firepower to respond to that and to, you know, to score enough goals to keep the lead, the lead intact.
It's quite funny you should say that, because at times that game reminded me of some of the Arsenal games under Wenger, where you could have won a game 5-4 or lost it 5-4. It was that type of, you know, we're fine up the front and just a little bit patchy at the back.
As a neutral, I only saw the highlights, but it was a very entertaining game. You know, it really was. You know, from end to end stuff, both teams going for them, both teams both opposing attacking the threats as well. And you know, as an advertising for the Premier League, I thought it was excellent.
I'm just going to say to our podcast family, when you watch Match of the Day, it doesn't tell the whole story, to be honest. Yes, they do crunch it down, and it's either in our favour and very often not. Just an interesting one. Darren England, the ref, has given 8 pens in 15 matches, but our saviour was Mike Dean. He was in VAR. Who would have thought, Jake? Mike Dean, of all people, for God's sake.
I know. In real time, it looked like a penalty, and Vardy did well, but I think he was, you know, he's got previous, hasn't he, Vardy, thrown in a dive. And I thought
it was when Ramsdale kind of, he saw what was going on, and he did pull back, very kind of Amdram, wasn't it? He went back with his arms wide open. And yeah. But the one that concerned me, Jay, was no yellow card.
Yeah, I didn't understand that. I didn't understand that. But like, I just wanted to go back to the Ramsdale thing. He made quite a good save from Fofana early on, didn't he? You know, and he hasn't had the best start to the season. You know, he had a few jittery moments against Palace, didn't he? And I think there's definitely room for improvement. But there's also, like Mitch said, there's also really good aspects to his game that he showed this season. And he's still young, isn't he? And he's still got plenty of time to improve. And I'm sure he will improve. I mean, I don't think nobody's concerned, are they, about Ramsdale? No one's, you know, we've all still got full faith in him. He's probably not done enough to displace Pickford from the England team yet, I wouldn't have thought. But to be honest, I don't really care about the England side that much, to be honest. But, we've said this a million times, haven't we? The fan base always need that person to criticise after every game, and maybe certain people went towards Ramsdale, but yeah, you know, it's the way it is, isn't it?
Well, I was on Richard Butler's podcast over and over and over again, and it was not that he was doing it, but it was a general thing about Odegaard, who I think is a fabulous player. And we kind of went through the whole thing with the Palace match that he was virtually sat on. As you say, though, it is one of those ones where people try to look for a scapegoat, even if there isn't one. Right, let's do the stats. Arsenal 49.9 possession, Leicester 50.1, surprisingly. Total shots for Arsenal 19, Leicester 6. On target for Arsenal 7, Leicester 2. Off target 8 for Arsenal and 3 for Leicester. It was quite a comprehensive win. We could have actually won that probably by about 6 goals, couldn't we, Mitch?
Yeah, Gabriel Jesus missed 2 really, really good chances. He could have had 4 goals in the match. We were absolutely peppering him. It was really, really fun to watch. And yeah, I mean, like, the goals that we conceded, other than like maybe like Ramsdale in the near post, like they weren't like overarching like defensive worries that we're worrying about. Like, we're like, oh, our defense got torn to shreds. Like, oh, Saliba was terrible. Like that none of those things were true. So very easily that match could have ended 6-0. We even had a penalty shot of our own on the other side. That in the case that the Vardy one was not given, that one was also not given, which at the very least, it's nice to see consistency, if not in general, then just within the same match. That's something that like we didn't see in the Manchester City match last year on New Year's Day, where the Xhaka penalty got given, the Odegaard one didn't. And, you know, that kind of like inconsistency is something we've struggled with a lot with Premier League refs. And so having, okay, if you're not going to give that Vardy one, yeah, don't give the one for Jesus. I think both could have been penalties. Both weren't. It's one of those like those tougher calls that is like the reason we have VAR. It totally could have been a way bigger scoreline. I think the scoreline is a little bit generous to Leicester because the performance was a 4-0 plus performance to Arsenal. We dominated that game. There wasn't a single moment where I was worried. And also there was 2 times in which Leicester brought the game back within 1 goal and we would just immediately put a nail in that coffin again. We like gave up the penalty, or like seemingly gave up the penalty as we were up 2-0, and then it wasn't given, and then we immediately go score a third. They get one back, they get another back, and then we immediately go score a fourth. Like, it was this immediateness that was like really, really great to see. That, I mean, we've yet to be trailing so far this season, but I'm no longer worried for when we are, because we only came back from in a match one time last season, and was that Wolves win, which was an awesome performance. But I don't think we had that like intensity to go get a goal. And also, we have so much more quality on our bench. Like, our bench for this match was better than every single bench that we put out for the entirety of last season. Like, really, really great stuff to have Smith Rowe, to have Nketiah as those attacking options off the bench, as opposed to like Pepe and like
El Nene.
We're like really, really improving our depth. And, you know, when it comes to Smith Rowe, where it's like, even if he's not starting every match, having that kind of quality to come in matches, like we saw with last season when he had that run of games where he was scoring in sub appearances, is really, really valuable. And it's going to make it so we can actually like sustain success, where we can win in different game states when we go down, or it's a tough low block. Like, we have these different players to unlock different situations. And, you know, there's a lot to be excited about offensively for Arsenal this season.
Right, let's talk about all or nothing. We've got a varied sort of menu tonight. Jay, have you seen the most recent three?
Yeah.
It's quite interesting that we should give Arteta, I know he's had a good bashing off various people, but I'm just going to read you this out of the changes that have befallen Arsenal. When he took over, his first side was Leno, Maitland-Niles, David Luiz, Socrates, Saka, Torreira, Xhaka, Nelson, Ozil, Aubameyang and Lacazette. And you can see, well, we read it out earlier, the team sheet. It's a massive change. That's been a massive job, hasn't it? And when you look at what United are suffering now, I don't think he's done too bad, do you?
No, he's done a really good job. And all or nothing, it shows that. And some of the interviews with the coaching staff and Edu, and they all say that, you know, tactically he's right up there. He's absolutely spot on. And I don't think that's up for debate. I think it just takes time, doesn't it? You know, he's had a fair amount of criticism in the way, you know, towards him, aimed at him based on his treatment of certain players. And, you know, there's been many people have turned around, or he's been criticised, but, you know, he doesn't like Aubameyang, doesn't like Pepe, doesn't like this Ozil, doesn't like, you know, but it's clear that, you know, a result of all or nothing, it's definitely shown that if you're not part of it, or, you know, haven't got the right attitude, then you're going to get eased out of the team. And obviously the team that you just listed in his first game, and the squad that he inherited. I mean, there were so many players that just, you know, it was obvious. You know, when you look at the team now, look how unified the squad is, and look at, they're all very, I know we've said this a million times on here, but the signings that Arteta's made, they all come across very similar type of characters. And you know, you compare this group to the one that he took over, and they were just, I mean, I bet they were all lovely chaps in their own way, but not what we needed for, you know. And it was, we weren't in a great spot. And again, like everybody's been saying, it's United are in a similar position. Their squad's full of players that maybe don't see themselves at the club much longer, and they're taking the you know, the large wages. And, you know, it took time, didn't it, for us to get rid of those people and replace them with hungry, younger players with maybe a little point to prove. I mean, long may it continue for United, you know, because, I mean, they're shambles, aren't they? And it was, I mean, that Brentford game, you know, we'd been there a few times ourselves, haven't we? You know, we, especially the back end of Wenger, and there was a few performances under Emery, you know, where we were just getting battered, and it was just, it was tragic, and you couldn't see how it was going to improve the attitude of the players. You know, you look at Xhaka, and you know his, you know, the whole telling the crowd to F off and do one and throwing the armband on the floor and that being allowed in the squad, you know, and obviously that's not the case now. And there's certain standards that Mikel's enforced. I mean, All or Nothing showed, I know it's edited in a certain way, but it showed Aubameyang, you know, what he just, you know, he just turned up in Barcelona, didn't he? When Edu didn't even know he was there, you know, and you know, Aubameyang's driving around in.
I thought you were off then, Mitch. I thought you were going somewhere. Yeah, he leapt out of his chair. I thought he was going to score a celebrated goal.
Yeah, Aubameyang's got, he's driving that Lamborghini and he's got a matching tracksuit, the same colour as his car. Like
the gold outfit, wasn't it? Just
proper tool,
yeah,
wasn't he?
Yeah.
What a weapon. Like, oh,
I tell you, seeing as you're our adopted toffee, Paul, you're in a toffee household, did you get to see any more of All or Nothing?
I haven't so far, sorry, Tom. I'd be lying if I said I had. But I have heard reviews about it in the paper, so I've got a working knowledge of what's going on. And I mean, just go back to what, you know, the points Jay's been making there. I know Mitch made these points about Arteta before. I mean, I think outside Northern Inn, he took on a really difficult job where there's a lot of players similar to Man United who were there, picking up the big books on long contracts, not really buying into the cause, not really buying into the vision. And I think from a manager's point of view, that's always one of the hardest things to do, move out the people who aren't on board, because they're the malign influence in the dressing room and they have an influence on the younger players. You want your younger cadre of players to come through believing in the manager, not listening to the pros who want big fat contracts, and you know, encourage them not to listen to the manager, not to participate, not to get their best. So you know, I think he's gradually, you know, that team now is more and more an Arteta team rather than the one he's inherited from Wenger and Emery. And I think as well, you mentioned some of the youngsters come from, like Smith Rowe. I've always been hugely impressed with Smith Rowe. I saw him about 4 seasons ago when he was playing against Everton, Goodison Park for Arsenal. And we all talked, saying, who is that guy? He's so good, I've not seen him before. So it's bring the young talent through as well. And if you don't do that, if you let the senior pros dictate the ethos of the dressing room, and you could have a view that towards the end of the Wenger years, maybe that was the case, then you're going to end up like Man United in a terminal decline. So I think, I know some of you guests on this show haven't been totally convinced by Mikel Arteta. As I signed up in, I think given the hand he was dealt, he's done a good job. And you can see, you know, someone like Gabriel Jesus would not have joined Arsenal if you didn't believe in Arteta's ability to bring the best out. So, and I think that's another recommendation for how highly thought of he is.
Mitch, it's been interesting from the point of view of, because there was all the Kroenke kerfuffle, wasn't there, and that bad vibe, bad feeling. And then we had Raul in lining his pockets and missing Tat, and it was all misfiring, wasn't it? This series has actually shown, especially with the Aubameyang situation, that Edu really has got his thumb on the pulse with Richard Garlick, and they're working as a team. And there was that feeling, Mitch, as well, that they wanted to slide Aubameyang back into the side. And Mikel said, I don't think so. Do one.
Yeah, I think it's a really, really interesting look at that whole saga that we didn't get to see. To see them like really working hard up until the deadline to get that termination done of his contract. I think, you know, a player on that high of wages who's like done that much for the club, like obviously you're going to want him to like be able to stick around. Like you, if you're Edu or Richard Garlick, you're like, it's going to be very difficult for us to get rid of him. And we saw what happened with Mesut Ozil when there was a falling out and like there wasn't anyone who wanted him because we just had to eat his contract for however long it was for that. And so it's a testament to them for actually being able to get something done with Barcelona where they were able to find Aubameyang a new place to play. And it was a really, really interesting look at their process and stuff like that. Obviously we don't know like how the conversations went with Aubameyang and Arteta when it came to potentially having him come back. obviously it didn't go great. And I think that like Arteta was pretty sold on like, okay, you clearly don't have like the drive to like work your way back. Therefore, like, I don't want anything to do with this. Like you're going to be a bad personality to have in the dressing room after this whole saga. It's best for the both of us if we just go a separate ways, which is like sad considering like what Aubameyang had done for the club, like the relationship that two of them had. But it's a testament to Garlic and Edu for being able to get those kind of deals done.
So it was interesting that Mikel was asked, when did you know that it was over, his career was over at Arsenal? And he said, when I looked into his eyes. So it was quite a revelation, really. Some people are a bit iffy about this series. We've spoken before, Jay, you in particular, saying that you don't want to see the club embarrassed or anything like that. And although there has been some sort of ridicule and mocking and all that sort of thing, I think we've come out of it very well, really.
Yeah. No, I've enjoyed it. You know, I have enjoyed it. We all know what's coming in the last couple of episodes, that, you know, might not enjoy them at all. But I've enjoyed, I mean, you know, I liked the which performance was it where Mikel had COVID? Was it
Manchester City?
Yeah, City.
Yeah. And, you know, there was so many parts of certain episodes where the squad are together and Arteta's working hard on really working hard on getting the squad to try and gel together. You know, they're all, arms around each other. And, you know, Mikel's personality is coming across really well. You don't get much of an input into the tactical side, do you? There's not really much of a tactical element of the show, you know, obviously that Mikel obviously didn't want that. But it's a good show. There's still part of me that wishes it hadn't happened because you do want things to stay behind closed doors. And I can imagine Mikel's quite enjoying the cameras not being there now, you know, and he's, and I can imagine some of the players enjoying the cameras not being there, stuck in their faces and stuff, but obviously the club were well paid. But it's a good show. And you know, for the neutrals, I can imagine it's really good. I enjoyed the Sunderland one, less so the Manchester City. But I'm sure when you watch it, Paul, you will enjoy it because it's good television and it gives you an insight into what goes on behind the scenes. You know, how Mikel handles the media, and how, you know, the day to day running of the club and training. But you don't get much of it insight into Arteta from a tactical point of view. But you do get a lot of drawings, don't you? You get a lot of Mikel drawing and getting his point across from that point way. And you know, these guys aren't brain surgeons, are they? You know, they need to be spoken to like that. They need to get their point, you know, Arteta needs to get his point across on a sort of a basic level. And you like to think that it's working now, you know?
I think that's the thing, isn't it? You know, we've got to accept. Paul, it'd be interesting to talk to you about this because we're all on this podcast. We're all people that are objective and we like to follow football in general, not just sort of our own teams. But there is a difference between the new modern management style as opposed to the old sort of Brian Clough kind of element, wasn't it? Brian Clough, case of light owl at halftime and a bit of a stare. And now you've got all this gubbins. You've got people coming in to look at your well-being and these statisticians and almost scientists in a laboratory. It's a brand new game, isn't it, Paul?
Oh, it absolutely is. I mean, I know we've talked in the past, Tom, haven't we, about maybe doing a podcast sometime comparing Howard Kendall to George Graham, because they were hugely successful managers from the 80s, but their methods now just would not fit in with the way the modern game is now. I know when Howard Kendall was Everton manager, you take the players out for the Chinese every Thursday evening, they'd have a skin full of beer, and they'd all express their opinions. But by the end of it, they're all together again. All the differences have been settled. Then they go out and play on the Saturday. And in most cases, deliver the results. I know George Graham had a very draconian way of managing his team. But once again, what he did for Arsenal at a time when Arsenal were quite a downwards spell of underachievements. I thought, that you've got the pitch there, Steve McMahon, the game at Anfield in 89, what Graham did there. I watched the film Arsenal 89, and it's just comparing that with All or Nothing, because that's just a snapshot of one game. But all the planning that went to that, even the little things like Graham's system that they travelled up on the motorway on the day of the game rather than staying overnight, so the players could see the fans, the psychology behind that, it's a simple thing to do, but you can see the effect of having the players, that they saw how much the fans were getting behind them for that game. They could, and even more so in that era when away fans weren't limited in numbers. If you looked at Anfield Road End, Arsenal must have about 6,000-7,000 fans behind the goal for that game, which you wouldn't get now. So yeah, the whole management techniques have changed. And as you say, there's all these additional supports, assistance, nutrition, psychology, et cetera, et cetera. And you do sometimes wonder when you see the list of people who are getting paid by the club what their actual job is sometimes. But I think when the Premier League first started, I think the model was the NFL. And more, I don't know what you think about this, Mitch, your experience stateside, but more and more, the Premier League is becoming like the NFL with all these specialist coaches, specialist roles, increasing number of substitutions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's definitely moved more and more in that direction, in my opinion. I may be wrong on that. And all the stats are in the 80s, we're talking football on a podcast here with Tom. You wouldn't be talking about stats, you wouldn't be talking about expected goals, you wouldn't be talking about assists, you'd just be talking about the game. And so that statistical analysis of football has changed dramatically in the past 30 years or so. So, my son's 21, he's really into all the stats and things, which is great for his generation. That's what they should be into. You're the product of the football you grew up watching, and you appreciate all the changes and innovations. But you can't escape the football you watch when you're a kid and how you viewed as a kid.
I think that you see that in every single sport, where every single sport has gone through like dramatic revolutions when it comes to stats and health and science and stuff like that. And I think it's just major developments in sports psychology and technology and stuff like that. In the NFL, for instance, there's so much technology that just goes into helmets, how to prevent head injuries and long-term effects of them. And so you kind of have to do that in every single sport, because you have to adapt. You have to, every single team is trying to find an edge. And so every single fan is going to want to learn more, or not every single fan, but a lot of fans are going to be interested in learning more. So you'll hear about something called with XG, and you'll become really, really interested in it. And you'll be like, you want to understand how it affects the game. How do clubs use these models to figure out tactical plans and stuff like that? And I mean, I think it's just a thing of every single sport and how it's evolved.
Two things left, chaps. We'll do the Bournemouth sort of roundup, what we think and stuff. But I found an interesting little piece here. It's on Sven Mislintat's time at Arsenal. And it makes pretty grim reading. Aubameyang cost us 58 million. I won't do all the prices and all that. Torreira, Leno, Sokratis, Guendouzi, Mavropanos, Lichtsteiner, Mkhitaryan. We spent 129.4 million. We got 27.7 million back. Now, it just goes to show that football has got a bit bonkers, and that if you don't get the bottom line right, the recruitment, then you're bang in trouble. And just a little adage extra about Man United, there was a piece from Carve Solicol. Can't stand the guy, not after the Tomiyasu thing, sorry. But he said 15 years ago, the Glazer family borrowed 600 million to buy Manchester United. 15 years later, the debt is still 600 million. It's been loaded onto the club. The place is shambolic. If you've not been to Old Trafford, it's like an old bin lid, isn't it? It's falling apart. Never mind the theatre of dreams, it's the theatre of rummagers. It really is.
Absolutely.
They're going to have to spend a lot, not only on the how much? They've spent £1 billion on that squad, and you've got Scott McTominay in it, for God's sake.
I'm fed as well.
They're allergic to buying a DM. It's really, really funny. Like, they've needed a defensive midfielder for years, and they're just allergic to doing that. Like, they just refuse to fill their needs. And, like, it's just been terrible organization and management by them for years. And now we're seeing it truly come to a head.
I'm not sort of mocking it, though. Sorry, Paul. I'm not sort of mocking it, because we found ourselves in that situation. It's not pleasant to sit there for 10 or 12 years watching the game pass you by and everyone doing proper business and having a great sort of time and being entertained. So we know what it's like. But sorry, Paul, you were going to say something.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think Man United fans can feel quite reassured with the news that Michael Knighton is apparently back in with a bid for the club, you know, to the guy that he bought from 1989 with his ball juggling tricks in front of the Stretford End. So, it could be quite
interesting. That's just what they need.
Well, I think he's 71 now. So he did an interview on the Reasonable ITV channel here yesterday. The guy's a basket case. So if he takes over United, I'll be delighted.
Right then, guys, up next it's Bournemouth. Jay, I'm going to kick off with you. What do you think Bournemouth are going to bring us? Is it going to be... You've got to accept that these newly promoted clubs, they're going to bring some energy. They're going to want to make a point and underline that. Are we going to get the full Monty Bournemouth, or have we got enough to just go out there and simply just slap them down?
I don't know what the full
Monty... Just move the mic stand.
I don't know what the Monty Bournemouth is. I don't know what that is, but it'll be a tough game. The atmosphere will be pretty good, tight little ground. But we should have too much for them. We should. This isn't the toughest game of the season. I think we will get a result. I think we could be a couple up by half time. And I think 2-0 win.
Well, that's very conservative.
Yeah.
What about you, Paul?
Yeah, I mean, I think as Jake said, that it's always tough playing a promoted team when they've just come up and it's only their second home game of the season. I think what works in Arsenal's favour is the fact that Bournemouth got hammered at Manchester City last week. So I think they're coming into this game now knowing that they've arrived in the Premier League and the sun's tough opposition. I think on paper, Arsenal have got way too much depth, quality and players to even, you know, they've got enough depth in that side to get a convincing away win. I think if Arsenal score first, then the game's going to be over. But Bournemouth is a tiny little ground, but Arsenal really have just got too much quality for them. So I'd probably go for, if you put me on the spot, a 3-1 win for Arsenal.
Oh, we're liking that, Paul. We love having you on the pod. Very optimistic. Some of these sour sods we've had on in the past. Mitch, what's your opinion? What are we going to do? How many are we going to score?
I mean, I like Bournemouth, but I think that they're one of my... I think they'll get relegated this season. I don't expect them to do all that much. Unlike Fulham and Nottingham Forest, I don't think they've made enough waves in the transfer window to really like improve themselves out of just being like a good championship side. So on paper... And the form we're in, we should get a resounding victory. But it's the Premier League. Anything can happen. So I would like to predict a 3-0 win. That's what I would like. But we'll see what happens in the match. Playing away in the Premier League, you never know.
What am I going to go? I think I will go with a 4-0. I think we're going to roll the goals in. I'm just getting too optimistic. That's the problem, isn't it, really?
We're winning the league.
By the way, I've just got to point out that last season we said that me and Jay, it was at the time, because you wasn't with us at that period, Mitch. We said that Arsenal would come fourth. They'd come fourth. Me and Dave pumped up Martin Odegaard and said he'd be captain. He's captain. And earlier on, me and Jay were talking and we said about third spot for Arsenal. So if that all comes true, where we're doing a bit of the Klopp. We've got a witch in the house. All that. There's not enough, not dry enough, not wet enough, but witches in the house. It's a massive book of excuses, isn't it? Chaps, I was going to do this, but we'll do it another time.
Tom, just before we go, can I just ask Paul something? Are you glad Dele Alli's left?
Hey,
To be honest, yeah, I forgot my with us. I mean, the whole thing with Dele Alli was a really strange signing because it was obvious when he wasn't getting play from the start, and he wanted that something was wrong. He turned off a training his first day game in a Rolls Royce. Now, you mentioned Aubameyang creating impressions. You know, when you come into Everton, you turn up your first day training in a Rolls Royce, it just does not create the right impression with the fans. He also turned up dressed for the fashion shoots, which, you know, once again, does not go down well with the fan base. So, I mean, personally, quite frustrating, hasn't worked out for him. And what I would say in his favour is that when he came off the second half against Crystal Palace, he did have a big influence in that game. So I am thankful to him for that. But all during the summer, Lampard's been making little remarks that he needs to train best, he needs to be more committed. And you think, well, hang on, this guy's on 100 grand a week and he's not even training properly. So it's, as far as I can see, it's absolutely no losses whatsoever. I'm sure there's linked to the fact we've got to pay 10 million when he's made 20 appearances. And I'm also utterly convinced that the reason why Richarlison went to Tottenham is that there was some behind-the-scenes deal that we would take Ali off their hands in January and they'd take Richarlison in the summer. I'm sure that there's something going on there behind the scenes. So will we miss him? Absolutely not. He's probably been our worst signing since the guy we got from Villa in January, El Ghazi, who played about 6 minutes in total.
Mitch,
so,
can't be set off.
Mitch, yeah, so, When I was at the Everton Arsenal game at the end of the season, we booed the shit out of him every time he was on the ball. It was very, very fun.
Yeah, someone fill me in. What happened? What happened? I haven't read anything about Dele Alli.
Dele Alli, he's gone to Besiktas.
Yeah. Not 100% yet. I think it's still up to him to decide, but like Everton and Besiktas have like agreed on it.
Yeah.
But it's looking pretty likely.
I think he's the same as he's been shown the exit door. So I think, you know, he's not going to get first team football to Goodison this season. He has to start out of the two games we have so far this season. So it's been a gamble that's backfired badly. But fortunately, you know, you mentioned those disastrous transfer dealings before, Tom, for Arsenal. Fortunately, we haven't spent big bucks on Alli. So we're not actually losing money by shifting them out. So yeah, it's a win-win from Everton's point of view. And I can totally understand why you're booing in the last game of the season as well, which, interesting enough, was the only time he started with Everton last season.
I'm not being funny, but Besiktas, I mean, what's that about? Who goes there? That's a bit like having your fortnight holiday on Streatham Common, isn't it? It's just, chaps, it's been an absolute pleasure. It's been great to have you all back as well, which is fantastic for the podcast, and it's been long overdue. We'll see you next time. Look after yourselves and take care.
Connor's back with a Gonna Get Into It special, this time with a player profile on Santi Cazorla.
It's time for the first player profile of the 2022-2023 season of It's an Arsenal Thing podcast. And what a player to start with, Santi Cazorla. Wow, well, the first words that jump to my mind when I think of Cazorla, pure joy, technical delight, a genius at work, just an outstanding playmaker, an outstanding footballer. And really, in all my years supporting Arsenal, I have never witnessed a player to enjoy his football as much as Cazorla did. He was always grinning, always smiling, always loving life. And of course, he was as comfortable with his left foot as his right foot, scoring delightful long-range wonder goals from outside the box, making his Arsenal debut, of course, on the 18th of August 2012 in a disappointing 0-0 home draw against Sunderland at the Emirates Stadium. But Cazorla would grab the headlines for breaking a record as the player to produce the most amount of clear-cut chances on an Arsenal debut. He created, listen to this, 7 clear-cut chances in that 0-0 draw. And Olivier Giroud, the summer signing who also joined in the summer of 2012 alongside Cazorla and Lucas Podolski, of course, he missed a gilt-edged opportunity with the goal gaping. He snatched at it when he should have buried the ball in the back of the net in the 82nd minute. Cazorla with a beautiful slide rule pass with his left foot, splitting the Sunderland defence. Well, he would do that time and time again from 2012 until October of 2016, when unfortunately That would be Santi Cazorla's final appearance in an Arsenal shirt during a 6-0 demolition of Ludo Goretz in the Champions League group stage. Cazorla, of course, was forced to undergo surgery on the heel of his right foot in December of 2016. An operation, would you believe, that was only meant to keep him out of action for 3 weeks. But it would then almost cost the Asturian his leg. And then doctors were telling Cazorla that he should be grateful if he could just walk again. And walk with his own son, play football with his own son in his garden. And would you believe, since then he has gone on to represent his country again. He's played for Villarreal for 2 seasons in La Liga and he has enjoyed an excellent time of it over in Qatar. He currently plays for Qatar side Al Saad SC and he has, last month, just extended his contract. He has signed a 1-year contract extension with Al Saad SC, which will keep him in Qatar until 2023 anyway. 37 years of age. And of course, if you're wondering how tall Santi Cazorla is, he is 1.65 metres in height. And for me anyway, I'm sure alongside a lot of other Arsenal diehard fans and Cazorla lovers, he'll be remembered by us as one of the smallest players to ever play for Arsenal, but still one of the most technically gifted players to grace Arsenal Football Club and the Premier League. And yeah, well, he started his professional footballing career back in 2003 for La Liga side Villarreal. He would play for Villarreal until 2011 before being signed by Malaga. And then he would only play one season for Malaga before being snatched up at a bargain price by Arsene Wenger. He was so good at that, wasn't he, Wenger? Signing the then 27-year-old Cazorla for an incredible 19 million euros only in the prime of his career. And well, of course, in 2006, he also spent a year-long loan spell at Huelva, the Spanish outfit, before returning to Villarreal. And well, incredible. So last year, the twinkle-toed Spanish magician scored 6 goals and produced 9 assists in only 16 league appearances in the 2021-2022 Qatar Stars League. He was born on the 13th of December 1984 in Lugo de Llanera in Asturias in northern Spain. And of course, he did make that first Premier League appearance on the 18th of August 2012. And he scored his first Arsenal goal in a memorable 2-0 away victory at Anfield away to Liverpool on the 2nd of September 2012. And on that day, Abu Diaby and Mikel Arteta, alongside Cazorla, as a three-man midfield dominated Steven Gerrard and the Liverpool midfield at Anfield. Podolski also scored his first Arsenal goal in that memorable win. But for me, the standout performance in an Arsenal shirt for Cazorla was that 2-0 away victory at Manchester City in January of 2015. He scored a penalty before sending up Olivier Giroud with a beautiful free kick. Giroud heading in Cazorla's perfectly weighted set piece. And well, if you remember that piece, I see it time and time again where he simply took on all of Manchester City's midfield and with his left foot, right foot, he was comfortable. Beautiful dribbler on the ball. He could go past players. And of course, he was deployed on the left-hand side as a winger by Arsene Wenger in the first few seasons at the Emirates. But of course, his most comfortable position was as a playmaker. That number 10 role behind Olivier Giroud. What a partnership Cazorla had with Giroud. Time and time again, we saw Cazorla link up and set up the French striker. But well, would you believe this? This is a stat that really caught me by surprise. Cazorla only made 129 appearances for Arsenal in total, scoring 25 goals and providing 35 assists in an injury-dominated career. And yeah, of course, it was 2016 when he was told that he might never walk again. And yeah, of course, 2013, on international duty, September 2013, when Spain were playing Chile, he would suffer an ankle fissure. And this is incredible. I was reading in the last few days that Cazorla revealed that he would cry sometimes at half-time and full-time due to the severity of his ankle pain. But he learned to live with the pain. He said when he warmed up, when he got the ankle nice and hot, he barely noticed it, but then it was after, when he was cooling down, I could just imagine the excruciating pain Cazorla had to endure throughout his career. But really, I am forever grateful to Cazorla for not just his technical ability, for his pureness on the football field. He just had so much respect for his teammates, and he just looked like he was so grateful to be out on the field to play every time he put on his football boots. And well, yeah, incredible stuff. Cazorla, what a player. Played for Arsenal from 2012 until 2016. He did stay with the club until 2018. Didn't feature though. And then went back to Villarreal until 2020. And well, he will forever be remembered as a beautiful, beautiful player. And well, for me, the best goal he scored in an Arsenal shirt was in that 3-1 win at Upton Park against West Ham in December of 2012. A beautiful left-footed strike into the top corner with his left foot. And well, Santiago Cazorla Gonzalez, an absolute legend. He is still playing at the age of 37, and he will play at least one more season in Qatar. He was heavily linked this summer, would you believe, back to a sensational, to make a sensational return back to Villarreal. And of course, Real Oviedo, who play in La Liga Smart Bank, the second division in Spain, they were also eager to sign the playmaker. But well, Arsenal fans, I'm sure you'll agree with me when I say Cazorla, an absolute legend, beautiful footballer, beautiful person, Santiago Cazorla Gonzalez.
Cazorla, I nicked him in the cash run out of Malaga. He'll take it back four down. He can play it left or play it right, or with his title flick it over ya. He'll take it back four down. Cazorla, I nicked him in the cash run out of Malaga. He'll take it back four down. He can play it left or play it right, or with his title flick it over ya. He'll take it back four down. And Bet says Chris is that he hadn't gone. Instead of being on the bench, he could have been having fun. We've got a better player, all the Gunners them know. He nicked him in the cash run out of Malaga. He'll take it back four down. He can play it left or play it right, or with his title flick it over ya. He'll take it back four down. Cazorla, he nicked him in the cash run out of Malaga. He'll take it back four down. He can play it left or play it right, or with his title flick it over ya. He'll take it back four down.
So, who are the most intelligent footballers? Former Premier League defender Clark Carlisle was crowned Britain's brainiest footballer in 2002. He got 10 A grades GCSE and then student mathematics and politics at A level. What about Romelu Lukaku? The striker can speak five languages fluently: English, Spanish, Dutch, French and Portuguese, and has an understanding of German, Italian and Swahili. What's more, he holds a degree in tourism and international relations. Has he got any in goal scoring? Frank Lampard reportedly scored over 150 in an IQ test with Mensa, which would put him in the world's top 0.5%. Why did he take the Everton job if he's that clever? Sorry, Paul. And just below Albert Einstein. He also has 11 GCSEs, including an A in Latin. It's time to eavesdrop on Ghanaian superstar sports presenter Akrabeto. He's a man who does what he wants when he wants and laughs at who he wants.
English Premier League. Chelsea 0. Arsenal 1.
So who are the clubs that can't fill their grounds, eh? Who's top of that league? Tottenham are the Premier League's biggest losers. Well, we all knew that. But what about filling stadiums? The thing is that they cannot fill their mega money new ground. The North London club lost the most money on empty seats last season, missing out on nearly £166,000 every home game, with attendance figures showing that they are falling well short of filling capacity at their new state-of-the-art stadium of 62,850. Tottenham failed to sell out the majority of their season tickets despite having the lowest prices for home games at just £20 and the lowest in the whole league. Next up is Chelsea, who are ranked second despite having 5,000 fewer empty seats. The West London club lose on average £154,000 per game, but have considerably higher ticket prices, with the cheapest for the season coming in at £47. And in third place, it's Southampton, who lose around £108,000 per game on an average selling of 28,996 of their 32,284-seater stadium, with the cheapest seats costing £32. The clubs doing the best business are Manchester United and Arsenal, who each have less than 1,000 empty seats on average each home game, despite having bigger grounds. That's it. We're all done here. My thanks to Silent Dave. You can find him on Twitter as SilentDave101. That's also the home of Jay, who you can look up as the Bald Gooner. While you're there, check out Mitch at Mitch Piotta and look up his blogs at Pain in the Arsenal. You can cozy up with Connor at ConnorJack2 on the Twitterverse, and Paul is at PMacCap. Look up Lauren on LaurenD2710. That's her army number. The podcast is on Facebook and Twitter. Look us up. Shout outs to Brandon Murphy, Dave Miller of Arsenal Attic, Simon DC, Let's Be Arsenal FC, which is twin to the podcast. Also, check out Ask Devils for opinion and news on all things Arsenal. Please like and follow this audio version of the podcast and subscribe to the YouTube version of the show. Want to say hi, ask a question, or take part in the show? It's an ArsenalThing4@gmail.com. More importantly, a big heartfelt thank you to you guys out there for all your emails, your encouragement, your support, whether you watch or listen. Until next time, look after yourselves and each other. And finally, remember this: North London is red.
Hey!